Welcome to this week's A Degree of Interest. This is part two with me, Monique Chambers, and my guests are again Nicholas Bella, Julia Vassallo-Eminian, and Roberto De Bono. Now, we're talking about PhDs last week, and you've introduced the school here that sort of helps PhD students through. I'm going to talk, obviously, a bit more about that. We've got Julia, who talks about she's going to cure cancer. Basically.
One type.
One type of cancer. But, you know, any type of cancer curing is good. Okay. And we're going to talk to Roberto De Bono a bit more, and he talks about the environment and health.
Exactly. It's about the global ecological crisis. So it's climate change, biodiversity loss, and what we need to do to find a solution to that.
And you were saying in the last program about research, the way you're actually doing your research is different from how you did your research for your bachelor's, and that the doctoral school that Nicholas runs is, you know, teaches you how to do that aspect as well, because there's different language used, there's different formats used, there's different requirements, and that's something that can be a bit off-putting, I suppose, for people wanting to approach a PhD, as you see the length of your thesis or how you're going to have to defend or how long it's going to take you. How do you address that, Nicholas? How do you ease people into changing the way they do things, but knowing that they're capable?
We have found that introductory workshops, in particular those which are about the method of how you do it, have served a good purpose. Because a student who might not have been introduced to the sort of way of doing things in a previous degree, or because the student came from a different disciplinary background, serves to see whether that student would like then to pursue further training. So we just give a 3-hour workshop or a 6-hour workshop, and then if the student is interesting to take it forward, then they usually approach the workshop tutor to see whether they can receive more formal training. And it has to come from the student, because a PhD is an independent piece of research. There's only so much that the supervisor can tell you what you have to do, because otherwise it's not going to be an independent piece of research. Mm. And by the end of the PhD, you are qualified in carrying out independent research. So the student is being given an introduction, and then it's up to the student to take it forward. And so far I've had very good feedback from students and tutors in particular, who are happy to show them the way, further training, etc.
Okay, because Nicholas, you were saying your supervisor is actually based out in Melbourne.
My external supervisor is in Melbourne. My main supervisor is from within the Department of Philosophy.
So how do you work with somebody in Melbourne? You know, obviously now we're online. Do you get to go there, or is this something you do online
We had COVID for the past 2 years.
Oh.
We didn't get, I didn't manage to get to Melbourne. But yes, I mean, today you can communicate digitally. Okay, Australia is 8 hours away, so it's morning for us and evening for my external supervisor. We communicate by email, and we've had a three-way chat as well between my main supervisor, my external supervisor.
Is it quite a lonely process doing a PhD? Is it something, you know, because it's your world? It must just completely take over everything. You know, you're obsessing, you're thinking all the time, everything you do.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's a lonely process. You do a lot of work alone, yes. You're thinking about it all the time. But maybe, luckily, I'm well supported to do my PhD. So I get lots of coffee meetings and lots of questions as well, which make me think even further.
Is the coffee key, or is it the meeting?
Both are important.
So is that part of it? Is there a social aspect with the programme that you have? Because this year you've got 100 students graduating. How does it work?
Yes, there are 100 students graduating over 2 years, because we did not hold a graduation 2 years ago because of COVID. Last year we did not have one either, so we grouped them together now in March 2022. And that's a good number. 20 years ago we had only 9 students graduating.
Wow.
Now we're about 40 a year, and the university has about 450 registered students, 110 last year alone, for instance. So you can see that there is the wish to pursue doctoral research. You asked about the social aspect. I still think that that is where we have to work, in the sense that the idea is for doctoral students to meet each other. And of course, they can meet at the basis of the department or the faculty, and perhaps talk about things which are pertinent to the discipline. But I think there is more to do to bring people like, for instance, Julia and Roberto, who might not have met before today, together earlier on. Why am I saying this? Because there is the possibility that once doctoral students meet, that will be the beginning of a joint venture after the doctorate. During a workshop that I delivered, a student said, "Yes, I am doing research in a field, which was understanding the need of carrying out exercise as part of a healthy life when you are a researcher." Then I met another student who was doing looking at the actual application. What do you wear in order to monitor the level of stress, anxiety, etc. when you are a researcher? And I introduced the two together because I said, if you join forces, then you can actually possibly patent the idea, the product, and sell the know-how. But if the students don't meet, so the social aspect is crucial. And I hope that in the next two years, when a large building project on the edge of campus is ready, the sustainable living complex, I have been promised a space there for doctoral students by the university. And when I was told what is needed, of course you need a few offices, of course you need a space, a hot desking space, where doctoral researchers who do not have access to a laboratory, for instance, can actually go. I can think of Roberto spending most of his time in the library to study. But he's on his own there. And, of course, he can get his work done. But what I'm really after is a place where you can actually be lazy, lazy in the good sense of lazy, where you sit down, have a coffee, and realize that you're not on your own in finding it difficult to compile your literature review or to sort a statistical problem.
And sometimes just to bounce an idea.
Yes, just to bounce an idea. And that is what we desperately, desperately need. And of course, during COVID, we sort of were comfortable in staying at home in our pyjamas and being able to work, etc. But I think what makes us human is our interaction.
Yeah.
You can never be able to fathom the feelings of a person on screen. You need to be able to listen. You need to be able to hear. You need to know whether what you're saying is being well received or not, and adjust accordingly. Mm-hmm. And these are things which you have to do when you are comfortable, ideally, in a social setting, and in a nice one too.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of having the doctoral school based in a sustainable living complex is very exciting. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to the day when this will become reality.
That's it, because I'm guessing, Julia, you know, when you do something and you're just like, yes, it did what it's supposed to do, that you want to have that little dance of success and have people like high-five you when you do it. But if you're at home, like, you know, it's not quite the same level of whoop, is it? So is that important to you? Because you do part-time work at the moment, but your study is full-time. Do you come to university every day then, or do you literally study full-time at home and then do your lab stuff?
No, I try to come every day, and then there's one day a week where I go to work. And also do some remote work, but I try to come every day because, as Nicholas said, it's the environment where you're in company of other people who are also in your same situation. It's not just rewarding when you have someone to rejoice with, but it's also comforting because you learn that other people are going through the same challenges as you, because when you don't open up, you start wondering, am I the only one who's facing these challenges, or am I the only one who's having trouble with this or with that?
I guess if you're just a bit stuck one day, if you just doesn't want to work for you, you can't get the words out, whatever, you just need somebody to pat you on the back, and like you would at work normally, like in a normal...
Yes, and even when you start to complain with your colleagues, for example, that something is not working, the fact that you're complaining about it, it's stress reliever in a way, but then they also give you their input of how they think that you can solve the issue, you know, another aspect that you might not know of or that you haven't thought of. So.
And that's because you can get quite insular, I guess, when you're focused on one track. So having somebody help you take your blinkers off, like within the school itself and just within the university, it must be quite helpful for you to realize you're not going mad, you know. It is something else. So do you have... You've got a scholarship to do your so that helps support you through it. What's the process of getting a scholarship? Are they advertised, or does somebody approach you and say, this drug company or this? How do you go about getting a scholarship?
So in my case, my project was funded by Alive, which is a charity foundation that raises funds for cancer research, and then they approached RIDT, which is the Research Innovation Development Trust.
They're the ones who do the life cycle. They do the bike rides and stuff on UD, don't they?
Alive.
RIDT gets money from life cycle.
But
RIDT gets money also from
other charities.
From other charities, foundations, etc.
Okay.
And that's another new thing.
Actually, I think I read about this recently, that you can leave money in your will to RIDT, which is a fantastic cause as well.
Yes.
Okay. And then RIDT collaborates with academics to distribute these funds for research projects. And in that case, then a call would be issued that a project is available and that they need researchers or research support officers to join the project or to apply for the project. And then that is how, in my case, that is how my project started off. But then there are also there's also Endeavor, which funds PhDs, and in that case, it's an interview process where you have to sit for an interview with the Endeavor team.
That's a good start to knowing what you're going to go through at the end, anyway. So is it an expensive process to do a PhD, Nicholas? Is it something, because I guess you have to support yourself, you can't generally go to work
full time. The cost is not high. It's slightly more in the sciences than it is in the arts, but in the arts it's a few hundred euros every year.
Mm-hmm.
On top of which, however, you might have bench fees, especially in the sciences, where you're paying for consumables, etc.
Okay.
In an ideal world, all PhD positions should be paid for, so that you spend time doing only your PhD, not having to think about other things. Because it is only when you sit down and concentrate on the PhD alone, on that research, that you can actually deliver the goods and deliver them within a good period of time, which should be 3, maximum 4 years. There is a clear interest. Because if there are 450 students doing a PhD here, at our university and many others abroad, then the interest is there. What we need to do is we need to spend a sufficient part of GDP, at least 2% of GDP, to fund research and innovation in the Maltese Islands. We're still far from that. It's getting better, but we're still far from that.
So do we have students coming from overseas to Malta as well?
Yes,
and that's something that you help with as well.
We do, and those are the fees, especially for non-EU, are quite high, and that can be a boost because you bring in money that can be, in part, even invested in further research.
And you'd mentioned as well about putting students together, and potentially there's an opportunity for them to patent an idea, sell it, commercialise it. Is that something you guys help with as well? Because that seems like a huge thing to do.
The university actually has a knowledge transfer office specifically to help researchers, including even academics, on issues of copyright and intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have also a Center for Entrepreneurship and Business Incubation,
mm-hmm.
SEBI, with its takeoff business incubator. So if you have an idea and you want to take it forward, there are people who can help. So really and truly, the university does provide all sorts of services. Ideally, we make the best out of using these services, because they're actually free. They're actually free.
Okay.
They're part of the package. Ideally, we attract first more researchers. We pay them for what they do, and we pay them properly so that they don't have to do a part-time job in order to keep them going. And then make sure that we monitor and we track what they are doing, encourage them to apply for more funds themselves.
And so then what happens, so Nicholas, for example, when you finish yours, what happens with your paper? Where does it go? What's your hope?
Well, I'm in my third year of part-time studies, so mm-hmm. I've got 3 more years to go. Because part-time, it's like on average it's 6 years. Now I look forward to presenting some of my research at conferences or in magazines. For example, there is Philosophy Share. It's a popular magazine. There are degrowth journals, scientific journals, so I intend to publish some there. There are workshops, for example, some are coming up by Princeton University. So
ooh,
I intend,
that's a good one.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one, yes. It's a closed kind of workshop, so it's not open, it's not public, but you get feedback, you can, and you see what others are doing.
So you want to sort of tour, educate... Educate.
Yeah, so the PhD is more of a start, it seems like. You're starting on a journey. Then you have enough research to start contributing, to start publishing something, to start presenting something which is useful, which is new.
And something that could be useful to human beings, like you said, which is...
At the end of the day.
And governments, hopefully, you know, introducing different policy, perhaps, mm-hmm. for
hopefully,
environmental...
Yes. Hopefully, yes. And sometimes it takes decades between academic publications and then policy and in practice, putting that in practice.
Is it something you monitor while you're going along with your study? Do you have to keep in touch with other entities, or you have to keep quite a closed book while you're studying until... is actually ready to be
I think it's the first stage you need to carry out a lot of work by yourself, the literature review you need to, but then I think in the second stage of my PhD, but I'm still starting my second stage of my PhD, the research has to start coming out and you have to get feedback on the research. Did I get your question right?
Yes, I think yes, so. Okay. Yeah, no, because it's like, you know, you put all this work in, and obviously there are some things that are obvious. You know, if you, Julia, can help to cure this particular type of cancer, mm-hmm. then you hope everybody, you know, somebody somewhere publicizes this for you, and it gets out there, it gets into, I don't know, the medical journals and mm-hmm. whatever, and, you know, people can start implementing it to start saying.
Yes. But as Roberto said, the PhD is especially when it's very novel, it's the start of a journey, and mm-hmm. even in my case, since it's preclinical research, then there's many more steps that have to be successful for it to eventually end up as a treatment in the clinic. So you would have to go to animal models, and, uh-huh. and then if it works in animal models, then that is when you go to trials, and if it works in trials, that is when you can... it can become commercialized and made into a drug that is administered in such situations. So it is a long journey, but, you know, it's always a start
Is that something you see yourself? Will you take that through, or is that you do the preclinical and then it gets passed on to, you know, somebody else? I don't understand the science, I'm sorry, but, you know, would you take this through and carry it, or is it that it's your name on the first paper and then it gets handed to...
It depends if the funding comes in to continue the research. It all depends on that, you know.
So it'd be great to hear your name in, you know, Grey's Anatomy or something like that when they mention, oh, this paper was written by...
Yes, would be great.
It's a life goal for you.
Yes.
Not just a PhD.
Yes.
You know.
But you have to have, as Nicholas said as well, you have to have funding to continue the research, because it's expensive to carry out experiments. And
I'm guessing there's a point in time where, you know, this is scientific research, has to be, you have lab time and things like that you're saying. But if you had to go abroad to study, that's even more costly.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I went abroad because I got two scholarships, both of them from the UK. And then I used a lot of my parents' savings. And the concern always at the end of the day is, will I make it? Because you owe it to those who supported you, who wrote letters of references, to family, etc. So there's always this big weight. Will I manage? Will I produce the goods at the end of the day? Will I answer my research question? How valid is it? How significant is it? And the reason, therefore, why you want to form part of a big research family is because those anxieties mm-hmm. can be shared with others. And also, there is the big issue of disseminating knowledge. When is the right moment to do so? Mm-hmm. Which fora do I use? Do I go public? because you can publish, it's fine, and you can use the information in a publication in your own thesis, and then you defend it. That is acceptable. You can publish as you go along. But, you know, if there is the chance of patenting something, once it's published, then you can't patent it. So that is where you need to have the advice of somebody to tell you, look, you know, hold your horses. No, this is not the time to go public, because there is, you can commercialize, you can register a patent, commercialize IP, etc. So it is far more complicated than one probably thinks when you start off with all that enthusiasm, because the moment you start, then you realize how much time and energy you are investing in it. And that is time and investment, normally away from loved ones, away from doing things which you would rather be doing. It is not easy.
But then doing it somewhere like Bristol, that's really a fun place to be.
Yes. So many years ago, it was brilliant, a nice city, and unfortunately a little bit too far away from London, which is where the big libraries were in my case. And I could not afford trains. I had to take the coach. So, but it was amazing.
Of course, because that was pre-internet as well.
The internet had just come in.
Yes.
The internet was about to come in. Wow. But if you wanted to get access to certain books, you would have had to travel, either Oxford, Cambridge, or London, and it wasn't easy.
So, despite just the internet being born, things like podcasts, you know, webinars, all of these things, has that made it easier for students? Are these things that you guys can, you learn from, or is it like, no, your subject is too far out, you're insular? Or I'm just saying, you know, you'll talk about speaking at other workshops. Mm-hmm. Do you gain things from other workshops? Do you get to travel at all for your, I know, post-COVID, but...
In this case, the workshop is also online, so it's like a virtual symposium over a two-week period, so it's asynchronous, they call it. But anyway, but the difference is that we have all the data at our fingertips today. I mean, we don't have to travel to get access to books, in my case. The library, we have a research engine, and then there is YouTube as well. Sometimes, I mean, it's not a scientific source, but you get information from there as well, from people who are quite influential in the scene.
There are also people publish videos as well on how to use certain instruments, for example.
Whoa! I've only just discovered kids unpacking boxes online, and I think that's random. So, but using literally scientific instruments online.
No, like how to interpret data, for example.
Okay.
Because sometimes
that would be really odd.
But they do show you, but like certain techniques, how you can do them, and some instruments like a flow cytometer is not just complicated to use.
It's showing off now.
But even the data analysis afterwards is complicated. So
there'll be quick ways to do it and show.
No, they show you how to do it, you know, like just how to start off. Whereas before you'd be, because when you're looking at published articles that are written by people who already know what they're doing, and you're trying to understand the figures, if you have no idea what equipment they're using or how to interpret the data, it becomes difficult for you to understand the findings that they have. And then after watching such videos, it makes it easier for you, you know, so it does really help.
So is this something doctoral that life. The this school's going to help with
this
as well?
This is what is being discussed here is how you are prepared to solve a problem. You are actually becoming proficient in a particular skill, which is solving a problem, but because the clock is ticking and the end is near, you really need to do it quick and fast. Mm. And although the World Wide Web is amazing, of course, there's a lot of clutter out there.
Yes.
So you really need to be surgical in pinning down what you want quick and fast. And of course, this is the skill which Julia and Roberto will take anywhere with them, wherever they go. Mm-hmm. Even to be good fathers and good mothers, really. This is the emphasis that I always place. Beyond the disciplinary domain, you are a better human being. And this is something that unfortunately is not flagged enough when we talk about a PhD, or sometimes even other degrees. But it is there, and we should really be promoting it. PhD is not just a doctorate in philosophy in a subject, but it is also about those values, skills and competences that we take forward to us.
And so just very quickly, so we have to wrap up the programme, for mature students that might have, you know, maybe had their kids now, maybe they had the bit of their career and they're like, actually, that thought is really bugging me. No, I still haven't seen something about that. Is the PhD perhaps a way for them to go?
Yes, if they are prepared to commit time, energy for it, then they should discuss it with an academic to see whether there is potential there.
So by all means. They can contact almost anybody within a faculty here at the University of Malta?
Yes, absolutely. That's how it usually starts. Yes.
Okay, and then we'll come over to your place for a coffee.
Yes.
A new place.
Oh, no, a new place.
Thank you.
And we'll take it from there.
But it's been seriously fascinating and... talking to you guys. So it's Nicolas Bella, Julia Vassallo-Eminien and Roberto De Bono. I really wish you all the success, and for the rest of your students and their graduation, I think, you know, go for it. Apply. Thank you for joining me on A Degree of Interest this week. I've been Monique Chambers.